Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today we are going to talk about an earth-shattering research paper that came out a couple weeks ago that I think everybody needs to hear because it's really shocking. It's going to, I think, just really open a lot of people's eyes to what's going on with student loans right now and just how nuts it all is. We're going to also have somebody, a special guest from our community, who we're going to talk to about the PSLF waiver, and we're going to maybe use her loans and her experience as a little bit of a case study just to show you the kind of questions that people are asking us with the PSLF waiver, the IDR waiver, and how people could benefit from it or maybe could not benefit from it. So we're going to do that later in today's show. But first, I want to talk about this research paper on the PSLF waiver. This is a National Bureau of Economic Research working paper. Authors of it are Diego Briones, Nathaniel Ruby, and Sarah Turner. So this paper is really amazing. If you type in PSLF waiver NBER, you might be able to find at least the abstract of this paper. Let me tell you why it's so shocking. Currently, about $8 billion of student loans has been forgiven under the PSLF waiver. There are billions more that will be forgiven under the IDR waiver, but they have not yet processed that because they have to go do a bunch of work on the systems so that they can even track qualifying credit for income-based repayment forgiveness, which is the 20 and 25-year versions. Furthermore, for the income-based repayment plan, they have to use the repay rules, which is 20 years for undergrad and 25 years for graduate school debt. So that's probably the rules that they're having to use. And so if you mixed in one loan from a graduate program, it's probably 25 years. And it's more complicated because there's no tracking mechanism built by Department of Ed, really, besides the NSLDS file, which does show your total amount of, you know, forbearance and repayment. It does show that. But there's nothing like that used to exist at FedLoan that got created in the early 2010s. Where it shows you your qualifying months towards the PSLF program. There's nothing built out for that for IBR yet. The reason I think that this is fascinating is because the PSLF waiver is farther along of what the IDR waiver will eventually be later this year because the infrastructure was built out a little bit more. And so they're really rushing to put together the IDR waiver infrastructure at the moment. That's one reason why there's no FAQ that has come out on the IDR waiver, at least at the moment that I recorded this, because they are scrambling to put together all of the logistics to implement it. I've sort of given you a little bit of a preview of things. Let me tell you the top line number that shocked me in this paper on the PSLF waiver. It stated that $8 billion has been forgiven so far in the PSLF waiver, but there is an estimated $145 billion, with a B, that is eligible for immediate forgiveness for public servants around the country. So there's, you know, $1.7 trillion of student loan debt or $1.6 trillion or so, right? And of that, a little under 10% of all student debt is eligible for not just forgiveness in a couple of years, immediate forgiveness. Now, that number is ginormous. I think that it's just brilliant of the authors to have come up with this. And it kind of makes sense because we can kind of cross-reference that number to other data that we have. So as an example, there was a response letter to Senator Elizabeth Warren. She requested, you know, how many borrowers have been in repayment for different numbers of years from the Department of Education, and she sent that in April of 2021. So this data is as of December 2020, which is it's a year and a half ago, right? So this is already very old data. What they produced is that about 15 million people have been in repayment for at least 10 years on about $660 billion of student loan debt. And so the $145 billion number makes a ton of sense because you're effectively just taking, you know, 25% of that borrower count at least and saying that that's the amount of people that should be eligible because 25% of the American workforce is in a public sector employer. And probably student loan borrowers are probably more likely to be in the public sector than people overall. Using that data to cross-reference this estimate of 3.5 million people that could qualify for $145 billion of forgiven debt immediately, that number makes a lot of sense based on that response letter to Senator Elizabeth Warren. And if we think about it further, this number is low. And the reason it's low is because I believe, you know, I might be correcting this, but I believe that data is based off of estimates from 2018, which is the most recent available data that the authors looked at. And it's clear that the numbers have grown since then in terms of the total number of borrowers, the total amount of debt that has been in repayment for at least 10 years. What I find really interesting is I think this was the plan all along. If you look at the way this letter was crafted, I think that the goal was to get Department of Education kind of thinking about how to group these borrowers in different buckets. And the way this definition that the response letter to Senator Warren was written, they looked at basically, you know, somebody's oldest loan. How long have you been in repayment based off of your oldest loan? And that's how they categorized everybody, because there's obviously people that take out debt for different programs. You go in and out of school, different degrees, right? So it's kind of hard to say, well, what bucket should people be classified in? And so basically what they did is if you have one loan from undergrad from 20 years ago, but you went back for a master's program 5 years ago, you're classified in that 20 plus category, which makes sense because that's how they ended up doing it with the PSLF waiver, right? That's why we know that the IDR waiver is very, very likely going to be using the same logic that the PSLF waiver did, where they give you credit for the loan with the most number of payments. And it's also why it's very likely that when the FAQ comes out with forbearance and deferment, that they're going to give you credit for forbearance and deferment based off of whatever number gives you the most highest number of payments, even though they haven't formally stated that in the FAQ yet, which we would love to see that, by the way, if somebody from Department of Ed is listening to this. If we think about the shocking number, $145 billion, 3.5 million borrowers. If we think about the debt amount of $660 billion, that's 10 years at least into repayment. If we just say 25% of $660 billion, that's actually $165 billion. And then if we say of the 11 million borrowers that are 5 to 10 years into repayment, you know, we could say since it's been a year and a half, let's say that we take a portion of those and include them in the having been making payments for at least 10 years bucket, if that makes sense. So in other words, this data from the response letter to Senator Elizabeth Warren is from December 2020. So we have to age that data forward to get an estimate of how much debt could actually be forgiven. So if we think about maybe out of the hundreds of billions that have been in a repayment between 5 and 10 years, let's say maybe $100 billion of that is now aged into the 10 year plus category for the PSLF waiver. Say a quarter of that's probably another $25 billion. If you add all the extra debt that's probably eligible now, we're probably looking at least $190 billion. And that's if borrowers are not more likely to be in public service than people overall in the economy. And they're probably more likely to be in public service. So that's probably an undercount. I think it's not unrealistic to say that if every single person knew about the PSLF waiver in the world and everybody consolidated perfectly and everybody applied perfectly, I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that $200 billion could be forgiven under the PSLF waiver. And when you look at the $8 billion of debt that's been forgiven so far, that's abysmal. That's really awful. That is going to increase inequality in student loans, not decrease inequality in student loans. And it's a consequence of a failed student loan system where Congress can't agree on anything. And so whoever is in the executive branch takes power themselves to do what they can with the limited powers of executive action. And then you just get a super confusing system. So that's why we have a dozen repayment plans. It's why we have a PSLF system that doesn't work. It's why we have to do consolidation and then applying for PSLF instead of just having it match automatically. It's really all because Congress can't agree on what to do. And so, you know, you get all these temporary programs from the limits of executive action that are being used to try to work around the program rules. What ends up happening is people with the biggest access to resources and the people who hire groups like us are the ones that disproportionately get the benefit. And so you can help get the word out to your friends, of course, that these waiver programs exist. I think that for the IDR waiver, I expect it to not be quite as bad as the PSLF waiver because there's no employment requirement for the IDR waiver. So if somebody's eligible for the IDR waiver, they're going to get it automatically if the loans are owned by Department of Education. The problem that I'm going to say is going to happen with the IDR waiver is if you look at debt that is 20 plus years old, probably 80% or more is owned by commercial FFEL lenders. So these are entities that, you know, don't have to forgive the debt automatically. And they're probably doing it that way because, again, to avoid lawsuits, because here's an update on the borrower defense settlement that we saw recently. The Department of Education worked with the Harvard Center for Senator, you know, for I don't know exactly what they're called, but the Center to Prevent Predatory Student Loan Lending. It's not their exact term, but that's roughly their title. And they agreed to this borrower defense settlement, and they named all these institutions. And the interesting problem with that is that pissed off all these institutions that were listed on this borrower defense list, where they basically said, based off of, you know, they're basically giving the presumption that borrowers would qualify if they apply. And, you know, if you're a for-profit school, if you were fraudulent or not, you can't afford to have your name on this list. And so there's already tons of lawsuits being filed by these organizations to block this settlement. And now borrowers are confused. And why is that the case? It's because Congress can't agree on passing a law that says this is how we're going to do borrower defense. So the executive branch tries to take matters into its own hands and does its best, but is limited by the fact that it's not Congress. It doesn't have the power to write laws, right? It has the power to enact them. And then things get thrown into the courts. So I think the reason why we're doing the IDRO and PS Love Waiver the way that we're doing them as a country is precisely because they wanted to try to get as much relief as possible for as many people as possible, but they were limited based off of what they could do through executive action, and they were limited based off what they could do with a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court, and they had to do it in such a way that would be confusing enough to not elicit a legal challenge. I think that that's the reason why they're structuring it the way they did. Now, if we think about who could get the IDR waiver, we've talked about why the PSLF waiver could result in $145 billion to $190 billion, or maybe even $200 billion in forgiven student loan debt. If you look at the balance that could be eligible for the IDR waiver, so there's $660 billion that's been in repayment for 10 years or more. Now, if we think about, you know, the 20-plus years group, that's about $211 billion. Now, you do have to realize that that is 25 years if you did a graduate program, probably. But that's stuff that's virtually all eligible. And plus, you had to have to age in the probably $50 to $100 billion that's now become in repayment for at least 20 years from that 10 to 20-year category from the Elizabeth Warren letter. I keep referencing this letter. I know y'all are not looking at the data like I am. But basically, just think that there's probably about $250 billion that's been in repayment for at least 20 years. Of that debt, probably the clear majority is eligible for forgiveness right away. But the problem is you have to consolidate if you have these commercially held FFELP loans. You know, maybe $100 to $150 billion could be eligible with the IDR waiver. That's a huge number still. So if you add up the PSLF waiver and the IDR waiver, it's probably more than canceling $10,000 for everybody. But really oddly, the amount of benefit people are getting is limited based off of their own awareness of the program existing because they need to apply for it in many cases. So if you think about the actual balance that's going to be forgiven for people, the IDR waiver, I would bet, is going to be bigger than the PSLF waiver because of one step of consolidation instead of two steps of applying for your employer and consolidating. So maybe the IDR waiver results in like $20 to $30 billion of canceled debt, and maybe the PSLF waiver results in like $15 to $20 billion of canceled debt. That's maybe $50 billion total, but the really terrible thing is like $50 billion out of maybe $300 to $350 billion that qualified. The people who got it were the ones that listened to this podcast, the ones that do their own research, the ones that had help or access to professionals that follow this stuff on a daily basis. And the folks who didn't get it are going to be disproportionately people that don't care about finances, don't follow things like this regularly, maybe are lower income and maybe only owe $20,000. And so it's just so confusing that they just decide they're just going to pay it off anyway. I mean, I'm frustrated, to be honest. You know, it's kind of like any program offered by the government. Anybody who's qualifying for it should have access to it. But just that's unfortunately not the way the world works, I guess. So we're going to try to do our best, both with our paid service where people don't have to worry about it because they're getting our help, and our free resources like our PSLF Facebook groups, our blog, our podcast, our newsletter. We're going to try to do as much as we can to raise awareness among this. But I wanted to highlight a couple groups now in particular that are eligible for the PSLF waiver based off of this story that came out this paper that came out from these economists. So they looked at the top six categories or professional categories that they think that could benefit the most from the PSLF waiver. This was one stat that stuck out to me. Half of all teachers could have half of all teacher student loan debt could be forgiven from the PSLF waiver. Probably not half of all teachers, because a lot of the debt is probably held by a smaller number of people. Over half of all teacher student loan debt could be forgiven immediately due to the PSLF waiver. So we're talking $30 billion is eligible. And probably my guess is teachers have probably gotten maybe about $1 billion forgiven so far. That's very small compared to the total amount of aggregate debt that's eligible. Other categories, number two, is the category called managers. This is a kind of a catch-all category of basically, you know, nonprofit professionals and people that kind of maybe work in the administrative sections of hospitals, right? And that group is maybe about $20 billion that could be forgiven. And then social workers, nurses, physicians, about a quarter to a third of all of their debt could be forgiven. And then this was pretty stunning to me, maybe a majority of all debt held by police, firefighters, and EMS professionals could be forgiven as well. So this is really stunning. One of the just shocking parts to me is just that teacher number. That teacher number is really stunning, where a majority of all teacher student loan debt could be forgiven. And I guarantee you, talking to friends that are teachers that have student loans, so many people are so unaware of this. It's really staggering. So with that backdrop of talking about the potential pool of people that could get the PSLF waiver and the IDR waiver, I thought it'd be pretty cool to have somebody on the show today that we'll talk about her loans a little bit. We'll talk about her experience, maybe talk about her professional background. And I think that you will get an understanding of why there's just so many misconceptions and sort of bad information out there about these waivers. And we want to spread good information and try to help you spread that good information to your friends and colleagues. So without further ado, now let's move to the interview section of the show. Today, I've got a special guest, one of our own community listeners to the podcast, Taylor. So welcome to the show, Taylor.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be here. I feel like I'm talking to a celebrity.
Well, internet famous is not the same thing as famous. I promise I do not get the cut in any lines at the airport security. So that's generous. Although I will say I'm feeling a weird increase in the number of people who randomly come up to me in grocery stores and start talking to me about student loans. Yeah. So it's interesting. I even had somebody at a donut shop recognize me the other day. I'm a little scared. I just hope, but our advice at Student Loan Planner is good, because if not, I'm at increased personal risk now.
Well, did they at least offer to buy you a donut?
I already have my donut selected, so I think that would have just been gluttony at that point. But but today we're going to kind of go over some of your student loans, Taylor. We're just going to use your first name for this, just to kind of keep people guessing. The one thing that is interesting about your loans is that you've got loans from different degrees, like different periods of your life, and you're currently in a program. So maybe if you just wanted to share with our audience what kind of balance you have, how you accumulated that balance, and for what.
Absolutely. So I pursued my undergraduate degree at Virginia Tech. My parents put the loans in my name, but are willing to pay back those student loans. However, after I got my undergraduate degree, I went right away to Johns Hopkins and got my master's degree, which I have public and private loans from. But I just last week paid off my private loans, which I'm really excited about. And now I'm earning my doctoral degree in counseling at the University of West Georgia. So in total, I'm around $83,000. I probably have a year left in my doctoral degree until I, fingers crossed, defend my dissertation. So yes, I am at $83,000. And I obviously work in public education as a school counselor. So my income is not meeting it. So that's why I'm so excited to talk to you.
Well, thank you for what you do, first of all. I imagine your job at this moment, kind of with all of the kids, just collective trauma that we've all experienced, I imagine is just really difficult. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. That's actually what my dissertation is on, the effects of COVID-19 and how that impacted school counselors' jobs, which ultimately obviously impacts the kids. I'm working summer school right now, and we have so many students who are in summer school because they have a lack of foundation from the effect and impact of COVID-19 and them doing virtual learning.
Yeah, wow. So talking about your educational debt for a moment, how much extra do you expect you'll have to borrow for your program? Are you done? Do you have extra debt to go? What does that look like?
I'd have probably less than $5,000. So the program is very different from Hopkins, where that cost me an arm and a leg. This program is a little bit more easier on the wallet. So probably less than $5,000, because I just have my dissertation left, which means I just have to stay in dissertation until I defend it. And that is around $1,000 for the class.
Now, in terms of your career plans, I assume your career plans are to work full-time at a qualifying nonprofit or government employer that would count for PSLF. Is that correct?
Correct. So I am obsessed with my job as a school counselor. I'm that one in a million person who, since she was born, wanted to be a school counselor. I wake up every day excited to go to my job. I have no intention of leaving my job as a school counselor in a public school.
So you have 5,000 to go. Is it correct to assume that you're just borrowing for tuition for this program?
Correct. It is just tuition. I'm still working full time. I actually have a part-time job in addition to being a doctoral student.
Now, have you ever talked to financial aid about borrowing more than the cost of tuition?
No. And that is interesting that you mentioned that, because I recently have just started to think about that, because part of why my dissertation is taking a little bit longer is because I have my full-time job and my part-time job, which leaves a little room for me to work on my dissertation. Because right now this summer, I am in 3 classes, but I need to pay the bills. So I have been working, which is really my main focus. And unfortunately, my dissertation is not the priority because I need to pay rent and et cetera.
Wow. So one really common mistake that I see a lot from public servants like yourself is you want to be responsible. So it's terrible to say that that's a mistake.
It is like in our blood. Like I can't help it. Like I've never had detention, done anything bad.
Yeah, I know. Well, here's the reality. There's the way the world should work and the way the world does work. And so when we think about programs that are messed up and complicated, like taxes, there are a bunch of tax breaks and tax loopholes and stuff that should they exist? It's kind of weird that they exist that way, but they do. Yeah. And so your choice are to benefit from those in the full way that you legally can, or to not benefit from those in the full way you legally can. So the reason I ask about that in terms of your degree program is most programs are going to, really all programs should let you borrow up to the cost of attendance for a calendar year. If you have room and board on top of your tuition for a really cheap school like the one you're going to, I would assume they might let you borrow, you know, an additional 10,000 to 15,000 per year on top of that 5. Is that correct?
That is correct. Like every semester, the amount they're providing me is way more than I'm accepting.
Right. So you could accept all of it. You could accept the full cost of attendance. Now, since you already have 80,000, which is going to be more than, I presume, more than your income as a school counselor. Is that fair?
My income starting in August will be 71,000.
Okay. So that is more. And so since you will have more anyway, you will be going for PSLF based on your career plans. What that means is the marginal cost of an extra dollar that you borrow is zero. Mm-hmm. So every extra $1,000 you borrow is effectively being forgiven.
Yes.
That's kind of an important thing to realize. So by taking less than what they're offering you, you're effectively giving away free money.
And I thought about that and I was like, am I crazy for thinking this? And I was like, oh, I'll just wait for Travis. So this is amazing.
Yeah. So that's one observation that can help you not have to take out any credit card debt. It can help you get into a position of cash savings if you do have credit card debt already.
I do.
So a lot of people do. It's very common in grad school. So you can take out the maximum for your loans instead of the minimum. So this is one of the things we do in our pre-debt consult, actually. Mm-hmm. The problem is most people don't realize how much benefit you could have by doing a pre-debt consult. So most people contact us when they've already gotten the debt out. And so that's one thing that I'd love to increase awareness on is there a way that you could take out the maximum and literally stockpile that money, even if you don't need it? And it feels bad. It feels wrong, but it's the way the rules work, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like I've committed my life to public service anyway. So I deserve a little bit like something on the side to help make this decision easier.
I know. I mean, I will say that it's weird that we don't incentivize like public servants to go to more affordable programs like you're going to.
I know. My master's program at Hopkins obviously has that name and it was a great program, but it was an astronomical price of what I had to pay. And, you know, for the past 5 years for my private loans, I've been paying $400 a month when really that could have been going to situations that I wouldn't be in credit card debt.
Yeah. So I think that's first observation is borrow the maximum because you're going for public service anyway. Now, the second observation is you've got debt from different degrees. It looks like you started borrowing for something in 2016 and you started borrowing for something in 2011. Can you explain? I guess that's your bachelor's and your master's, but maybe you can explain a little bit about those programs.
Yeah. So the 2011 is my Virginia Tech degree, my bachelor's in psychology. And then the 2016 is my counseling master's from Johns Hopkins.
Were you working full time during any of those periods in between, say from 2016 on?
Yeah. So Virginia Tech, I was not working. And while at Hopkins, I had a part-time job.
At Virginia Tech, you were not working. At Hopkins, you had a part-time job. Now, what about from 2018 until now? How often have you been employed at a full-time qualifying employer?
I have been, since 2017, a full-time employer of Fairfax County Public Schools as a school counselor.
Okay. What I'm seeing in your file is that you've been in repayment consistently since 2018, and you started into the COVID forbearance like everybody else did, March 13th, and then you went into in-school deferment when you started your doctoral program. Does that sound about right?
That's exactly right.
So part of the issue is this in-school deferment that your other loans were put into. If you were already done borrowing, what would happen from the PSLF waiver is you could get credit for everything since 2018, which is when you started, started making payments on your loans after your grace period for some of the debt. So 2018 until now is like 4.5 years. You know, obviously that's a pretty big deal. Now, the thing that's causing issues for your situation is that you're still in school. You're still in a program.
Exactly. And that's what I need your advice on. Cause I feel like I read every single newsletter you send out. I send it to like all of my friends. But now that I'm in deferment, I'm in deferment and there's been the pause, which I know if I wasn't in deferment, I should be still making the payments because that could count. But since I'm in deferment, I've not been making the payments because I thought that that wouldn't count.
Yeah. Well, it's fine that you haven't been making the payments. The real question is, you know, there is a in-school deferment reconsideration form, at least there was at Fedloan Servicing, and you are at Mohela. So what theoretically could be possible is you could request a reconsideration of that in-school deferment status because you could have waived it, but we don't yet know what that loan form is going to look like at Mohela.
Yeah.
And so the real thing is you can do a lot of things, but what a lot of times we'll tell people is you can do a whole lot of stuff, but is it worth the stress? Is the potential benefit worth all of these extra steps and just adding anxiety and pressure onto yourself? So in your situation, I would think it's probably not. Now, you would want to get your employment on file because you never know. So you would probably want to apply for the PSLF waiver the same way everybody else is.
I would do it every single year. I have it in my calendar. I call them. They probably have my name on a list of do not accept her calls because she calls so much.
Well, we see that you've got 4 years certified already. So that's certainly a really good thing. Now, if you were going to be done, like I talked with this case with another one of my consultants, and we were sort of like, well, what if she like intentionally dropped out of school to consolidate all the loans, you know, in time for the waiver to get the 4 years of credit?
Yeah.
And that's an example of overthinking the rules.
Got it.
So in your case, you have the credit on the loans, you know, that you've got from those prior programs. That's 57,000 of the 81,000 that you have. The reason that still results in somewhat of a benefit is, let's say you were done borrowing, or you were about to be done borrowing, you'd have about 24,000 of debt. Now, under the pay-as-you-earn plan, you can cap your payments. So that first batch of loans might be forgiven. And then the remaining batch of loans, you might pay about 1% of that 24,000 left for the few years difference between the two different loan batches.
Yeah.
240 a month, that's fine. That would still result in a significant balance left to be forgiven. So there's no real stress from that perspective if you're signed up for the right pay-as-you-earn repayment plan. The thought about the in-school deferment, like whether or not it makes sense to get out of that. So you could actually probably consolidate the loans that you have from these prior degree programs. The problem is I don't think there's much of a benefit in your case.
Okay.
So, you know, if you look at the balances, you know, again, we ask, is this worth it? Is this worth the stress and anxiety and all that stuff? And I would say probably not. And a couple more reasons for that. One reason is your payment is about $300 a month, give or take, I think. That's not really high, but it's also not super low.
Yeah.
And so we might as well go ahead and continue this in-school deferment and not stress yourself out, because it's not going to make a huge difference anyway, since you're going to have to make some payments on that remaining batch of loans. And I think the key observation is to max out what you're being offered instead of taking only what you need.
Yeah.
If you do take out that max amount, we can also help get that loan payment a lot lower. So this is a hypothetical, because I know this is a public podcast, right? But let's say you decided to get married, and let's say you got married to somebody about your same income and that has no student loan debt. Is that a reasonable, you know, expectation to have at some point?
Yes. fingers crossed, I'll get engaged soon. But yes, he does have a little bit of student loans, nothing crazy. And he makes almost triple of what I make.
So that's going to be something where you'd have to look at the tax consequences of filing separately, right? So that could be, I mean, and in some cases, it's not super common, but in some cases, the benefit of filing separately is just not there. And there are cases where we've seen people decide to just go ahead and refinance their loans if they have a five-figure amount of debt like you have, and you're looking at really large tax consequences from filing taxes separately. So just to get an idea of what those tax consequences might be, I just threw in a couple quick numbers in my estimator that we use for consults. And it looks like that probably the estimated amount extra you'd have to pay in tax might be around $2,000 a year, maybe $2,000 to $3,000 a year.
Okay.
Now that's if you do not save for retirement. So if we estimated that you saved for retirement, what that's going to do is it's going to increase the difference in your income, and it's going to increase your taxes from filing separately. So a lot of people don't know this, but the way kind of married filing separately works is the larger the difference in your incomes, generally the larger the difference in your taxes, because it puts the higher earning spouse in a higher tax bracket. So if we kind of look at that income, so you know, it's probably a $2,000 to $4,000 a year extra tax bill. And so that's not what you would ideally want, but I will say that getting married does reduce your student loan payments. So let's say that you get married, you now have the ability to save more for your retirement accounts, because I think you said you have a 403B and a 457, right?
Yes, I'm doing both of those. And then I have like both my pensions that I match as high as I can with my school system.
So let's say that you put away $20,500, which is sort of the max in one of those accounts. If you did that, that's going to lower your taxable income from $71,000 to about $50,500. And if you get married and file taxes separately, your monthly payment on your student loans would drop from about $300 a month to about $190 a month. That's a fairly significant drop. And that's only if you max out one account. Now, in addition, if you all were to have, let's say, a couple kids, right? Maybe if that may or may not be your plan, but if a lot of people tend to do that. And
in
then,
a couple of years, definitely.
Yeah. And so then that would drop your payment further from about $190 a month to about $80 a month.
Okay.
So you can kind of see what I mean about the payments being super low. And in your case, the PSLF waiver not really mattering that much, because you're going to be in a full-time employer anyway for a decent period of time. And so the main goal overall in your case is not so much to get you out of debt as fast as possible, but to minimize the total amount you pay.
Definitely.
You know, and that's just because those are your career goals. You know, it might be different if you had different career goals, but that's pretty interesting to think about the benefit of saving in a pre-tax account. So you might look at your options for your retirement and think, oh, I want to do a Roth, right? I want to do a Roth because I'm making five figures and I want to, you know, pay taxes now so I don't have to pay them later. The problem with that is all of your earnings above about $50,000 would get taxed at about a 22% rate because of the marginal tax rates. So throw on state taxes of 5% and throw on pay-as-you-earn tax of 10%, you're actually almost being charged 40% in taxes, even though you're a school counselor, on your marginal tax rate. That's really quite high.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
So that's one reason why we would recommend a pre-tax contribution instead of a post-tax contribution, because it would reduce your taxable income for the student loan programs. And it would also save you taxes at a very high tax rate because of just where you would be falling in that marginal tax bracket. Thinking about the loans overall, I think that if you were able to get the payments down to that really low level that we talked about, assuming you have zero credit at all, your first year, now you've been, I guess, working. So when you finish school, you will have a prior year tax return. Most people would not, right? So most people would come out and they would pay zero a month for 12 months, even regardless of the student loan payment pause, because your AGI for the prior tax year is usually zero when you're enrolled in the program. But in your case, you would not have been. So if you can save a lot for retirement, which if you're taking out more debt, you know, for finding living expenses, that also makes that more realistic, right? So your total payments over 10 years would be about $14,500.
Okay.
So 14,500 over 10 years. And this is after you graduate. And since you would be, you know, having those loans forgiven later anyway, I would probably just accept your in-school deferment, because that means you'll get to keep that in-school deferment. You won't have to make any payments.
Yeah.
If you're really intentional about your taxable income in the year before you graduate, like this year, if you're going to graduate in 2020, are you graduating in 2023?
That's the plan, August 2023.
Okay. So if you're going to graduate in 2023, then your taxable income this year is pretty important, because that's what your payment would be based on when you graduate. Okay. So you would want to really focus on putting a lot of money in your pre-tax accounts this year and try to get that taxable income to be as low as possible. So your first 12 months of payments from August till 2023 to August 2024 are low.
Okay.
Now, in addition, you'll have to decide whether or not it makes sense to consolidate. There could be different rules in place at that time.
Absolutely.
On prior payments of, you know, towards loans. So if they happen to count prior payments made before a consolidation, it would make sense to consolidate everything. If you are dealing with only, you know, if it's not the case in August of 2023 and your remaining debt that you borrowed for your doctoral program can't get added into the rest of it, then you probably would just consolidate only the doctoral debt by itself. And the goal there would be, instead of a 6-month grace period, you would accelerate things to a 2-month holding period, probably maybe even 1 month, while you get your loans set up for repayment.
Yeah.
It's a rather bizarre system.
Yes.
but the key thing is, overall, over 10 years, like, your cost of education for all the education you've received is effectively less than half of what most people leave undergrad with.
Absolutely. No, that'd be incredible.
I mean, you know, you think about the career opportunities, the education, the tools that you picked up over time and your education, like, what a wonderful path that you've made. And the decision to go to school, if it's represented as a $14,000 cost instead of a $115,000 cost, that's night and day.
Absolutely.
And yeah, it makes all the difference. So what type of questions would you have about this plan, Taylor, hearing this?
Okay. So forgive me. It takes me a little bit to process. Essentially, you're saying stay in deferment. And then once, hopefully, I graduate in August 2023, I would, because I have, it has to be like an income-driven plan, right? So then I would apply for that, and they, because they put me on the pay. So then they would put me on the plan, and then I would keep making that payment until I get to 120 payments. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully they would forgive whatever that amount is.
That's right. And the batch from your master's and bachelor's would probably be forgiven 4 years before the rest of the doctoral debt, right? So that could result in you having a payment that's capped. It's very unlikely because of the income projections that we made. But if your payment did happen to be capped, it would be capped at 1% of whatever the remaining debt is from your doctoral program. So let's say that you have $30,000 of debt. What you might want to look at is, okay, I'm paying $80 a month on pay as you earn. I'm paying $300 a month if I cap my payments after this first batch is forgiven. But I'm also paying an extra $300 a month in taxes from filing separately. Mm-hmm. So since $80 from pay as you earn plus the $300 from filing separately per month, if you like say like what's the cost of filing separately per month, that's where I come up with that hypothetical number. Mm-hmm. What you want to do is ask, like, is the cost of filing separate taxes plus payments, is that worse than just letting my loans be capped at the payment on pay as you earn? And then being able to file jointly so I don't have to pay that extra amount in tax.
Yeah.
So that's kind of complicated. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, we spend a lot more time like delving into.
Certainly. Absolutely.
Yeah. But that's kind of the loan kind of questions that we would look at answering. The other thing that we probably would look at on a consult too is we would ask, what do you have in terms of like, when do you want to retire? Now, you said you love your job and I assume you would get a pension. So you would probably think about retiring just at a relatively normal age, right?
Yeah. So I think it's like, I think I looked at it this year, it's like 2050 or something like that.
Okay. If you are maxing out your retirement and if you have a partner that you get married to that you're working towards the same financial goals and you're also, they're also saving for retirement and saving in a brokerage account, the reality is if you increase your savings rate to that level, like, you will have the ability to retire in your early 50s.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you would think about is if you want to switch to a different schedule, either one of you really, if either one of you wanted a more flexible schedule that gave you access to more choices in your career, that would be okay to do. Like, that's something that savers really need to hear. Like if you're already doing a really good job saving, maybe switch to putting more into experiences and, and a better quality of life, you know, and don't beat yourself over the head. So that what that might mean for you is you love your job, but like maybe for summers, enjoy them, you know, or enjoy.
That's like right now I'm working summer school. I had tutoring before this interview for my separate job for an executive functioning coach. And then after this, I'll work on my classes for my two papers that are due. So it's, I really don't get a break and we don't have kids right now, so it's okay, but that's not always going to be the case.
Yes. So given all those things, I think that you're really in good shape. Like overall, like just, I think the main thing for you is just knowing, yes, you should borrow more. Yes. Okay. You should just accept your in-school deferment.
Okay. So I got an email the other day from my West Georgia, my doctoral school, saying that I was like near the maximum amount. And I tried doing research about that and I didn't get a lot of information.
So you can be at a max amount for aggregate like Stafford loans. So there's unsubsidized Stafford loans that you can take out for grad programs. And there's very firm borrowing caps on that. So I think for probably a doctoral in education, it's probably $20,500 per year. Okay. And there's also an aggregate that is for programs like overall. If we look at your unsubsidized loans represent almost everything that you have.
Yes.
Yeah. And so if I look at like Stafford unsubsidized maximums in the aggregate, so there's a very strict amount for undergraduates at $57,500. For graduate students, I believe the amount is $138,500. And there's a couple ones that are larger than that. The good news is that you can take out grad plus loans for any debt that you need above the max Stafford limits.
Okay.
So this is the workaround that all professional schools basically use is you hit the cap on your Stafford loans and then you just take out as much as you want in grad plus.
I did not know that.
Yep.
Okay. I'm writing all this down, even though I'll listen to it later, but I'm still writing it down.
That's common. Yeah. We send people written recaps of conversations that we have too, so that people are aware of what steps to take.
Absolutely.
Here's an interview question for you.
Okay.
Teachers and school staff are the single biggest occupational group that could get their loans forgiven during the PSLF waiver. They could consolidate and apply, and more than half of all teacher student loan debt, and I'm including staff in that category, could all be wiped away with the PSLF waiver. But we're finding a very small proportion of eligible people are taking advantage of this, much lower than, say, other professions that have higher debt, like physicians, for example. What would you say do you think is causing people in your teaching and counseling fields, like what's holding them back, do you think, from trying to take advantage of this opportunity?
I can tell you exactly, because I talk about this all the time. I'm actually setting up like a panel interview with your team, because like you, you're so passionate about it and you want to help others. That's how I feel about it. Like I've shared your newsletter with over literally 50 people, and that's why I want to set up the panel with people who work in my county, because I think it's just such a overlooked, an amazing program that people could benefit from. But when I talk to people, they very much think like, I heard no one gets approved. I've already made a certain amount of payments. I don't know where to start now. It's too confusing. I don't know where to start. So I think it's their perception, which obviously it's getting better, but for a while, like only a couple people, I feel like we're getting approved that we know of. Like I always follow everybody on Twitter. So I think people just thought it was like a process that was never going to happen. So they're like, oh, I'll just make the payment and give up.
I see. So basically people just don't have the trust in the program.
Yes. Yes.
And it's confusing.
Correct.
Right.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's why I share your stuff, because I'm like, they make it less confusing. And there's so much, you know, I actually love Mahela. I had them as a provider for my other loans and I thought they were great. Whereas FedLoan, I had a lot of issues with. So I feel like with this change, there could be such more room for people getting approved with a smoother process. But I think people just don't have the faith.
Yeah, that's tough, because our team, like, you know, I don't know if you saw that we're doing the repricing, you know, starting September 1.
I saw that.
So like we are very concerned about reaching teachers, reaching lower income individuals in particular.
Please.
I guess the one reality is like our cheapest consult at $395 is already a lot. Like it's already a lot for a teacher. And I get that. Like my dad was a teacher, but for like higher income clients of ours, it's no big deal, right? So I think that's one of the reasons we're trying to get more of that free stuff out there for people. Like I kind of am thinking that, well, maybe 10% of teachers might hire us because of those budgetary concerns, because of that fear of like, can these people actually help?
Yes. You know? I mean, that's part of the reason why I asked to do, honestly, to do the podcast, because I don't have a lot of money right now.
Yeah.
And for me, I was thinking like, if I could do this and then I could schedule the panel, I could help you guys out by introducing, because there are people in my profession who their spouse makes more money, so they could afford paying for the consult. Like even at my summer work, I have three people who are like, you need to tell me everything that Travis says on the interview. So I'm working with your team right now to set up a meeting with these teachers. Cause I think if they listen to you all, they absolutely be like, you know what? This is an investment in my future. I will put out the $300, the $400 to schedule a consult.
And that's the thing is like, anybody can do that, by the way, like the webinar, you know, mm-hmm. if somebody is listening to this, reach out to help@studentloanplanner.com on our team. Basically, we just ask that you get together a group of at least 20 people through an association or like maybe your teacher's union or whatever it is. And we'll do like a free group call with everyone. And the theory there is like a couple people will see that, like you said, Taylor, and somebody will have more access to resources or something. And it will make sense for them to hire us to be able to do that. One thing, like just going over your situation, we're showing that you should borrow the max with grad mm-hmm. plus loans is that's something that's kind of, again, feels super irresponsible is people could literally take out the max for grad plus, have no credit card debt plus savings in the bank and be able to afford advice like ours.
Of course.
To optimize it. But people don't know that. And if you don't know that, you're not going to go do that, right?
No. And I think this is going to sound But when I first started following you years ago, I was like, this guy seems too nice for this to be real. Like this advice is so incredible and it sounds jaded, but the world is such in a cynical place right now. Like I was like, there's gotta be a catch to it. And then the more I listened to the podcast and I got the newsletters, I was like, no, this guy's just passionate about helping other people and wants them to have financial freedom, which I think, especially in my generation, like so many of us are in credit card debt and are too afraid to talk about it. And we're silently suffering. So the more that we normalize, like the experiences we're all going through, I think as a society, we would be in a better place.
Well, the listeners won't be able to tell this, but I'm tearing up a little bit, you know? Well, I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's hard sometimes. It's amazing sometimes like what people blame us for. Like the other day I got an angry email from somebody that found out about the double consolidation process for Parent Plus loans on our site. And then they called their loan servicer and demanded the loan servicer explain the double consolidation for Parent Plus to them. And the loan servicer was like, what are you talking about? Like, we don't even know that this is a thing. Like, how,
yes.
Like, and the person emailed us and said, they're going to report us to the Department of Banking or something because that should be free. And I was like, well, first off, we read our blog post for free.
The advice like, is free.
Yeah, the advice is free. And you're going to report us for being free and for finding something out. Like, I don't know. It's just like sometimes we have stuff like that that happens. And you know, that's like probably having to deal with parents or,
yes.
or kids. Like,
yes.
you know, so you get it. Like, and I think anybody in like a person facing type
Human
business.
Sir, yes.
Yeah, gets it. But it is really hard. So it is really rewarding to hear that from people like you. So thank you, Taylor,
no,
for saying
of course.
That.
And like I was saying, at summer school this summer, I'm with a new staff that I've never worked with before. And I started talking about student loans. Everybody gravitated to the table and was like, oh my God, I've never talked about this with someone because I'm so embarrassed. I don't know what to do. I'm hiding it from people. And I'm like, you guys, we're all in this situation. Like we all had to take money out unless, of course, we are very privileged to get where we are. And we know we don't make a lot of money. So we all are in this boat. Like, why don't we each get a paddle and like swim over this wave together? Having people like me who aren't afraid to talk about it, setting up those meetings will help you guys reach more people. Fairfax County is one of the largest counties in the world. We are the top 10 in the United States and top something in the world. We're right outside of DC. So by me talking about it with people in the county and setting up that meeting, it should help a lot of people and you all.
I think that you can reach people that we can't. Like people will listen
Definitely.
To this podcast. Like some people that are friends with you might listen to this podcast yeah. who would normally not listen to it.
Yes.
But I am fully aware that this is dry stuff sometimes. Like,
no, people, I'm a nerd. Yeah. I'm doing my makeup in the morning. I am listening to the two girls or you doing the podcast.
Yeah.
I know I am an anomaly in this situation.
Right. That's why we need people like you to be the ambassadors for
yes.
other people. Like, yes. at the end of the day, our business will be fine. Like, we will make enough to do what we need to do. And so that's why we want to reach more people and raise that awareness. So everybody on this podcast can help with that. So think about that there are, and this is not just teachers, this is nurses, physicians, fire police, any public servant. And also we're about to have the IDR waiver to talk about, which is an even bigger group of people that's in the, you know, for-profit kind of world as well, right? I guess that would be the ask, because everyone listening to this podcast, like, take what you learn and share it with others. And, you know, if we have something that's helpful, thank you for sharing it. But the goal at the end of the day is, how do we reach that teacher who's 45 years old, who's a single mom, who's like really busy and stressed and is scared about student loan payment starting again and doesn't have $500 to pay us for our advice? You know, how do we reach that person? And I think the listener and you, Taylor, for what you're doing are a huge part of that.
Yeah, it's definitely word of mouth, and it's going to sound silly, but like, I already know I'm going to go on my Facebook. There's a bunch of people on the like Fairfax County page. I'm going to say, hey, who's interested in joining this? Here's what they're about. Like, there's no gimmick. And I'm so excited because I think they'll tell other people and it will just go so much more. But like, every time I listen to the podcast, it's not teachers, it's not school counselors, it's not school social workers or school psychologists yet. We are like the backbone of this country. We are the people educating our youth, and we're like silently suffering. And right now we're in a teacher shortage because people can't afford to be a teacher right now, as sad as that is. So I think just giving the teachers and educators like a glimpse of hope will just do a lot.
That's awesome. Well, I guess the call to action for this one can just be like, get us to present to your group, right?
Definitely.
So help at studentloanplanner.com for the listeners that are thinking about this. We'll connect you with our team like Taylor did and reach out to us. I will say that we don't have a ton of capacity to do these one-on-ones like we do with Taylor. But you know, if you want to pitch yourself, we do have a podcast guest form that you can pitch yourself with. We're open to it. And I think the goal is just to magnify everybody's reach and influence yes. and stuff. So yeah. So any final parting words of encouragement for public servants out there?
Oh, okay. Well, first I just really have to say thank you to you. I feel like you are an angel on this earth and the sunshine in really dark days. You don't understand, for years now, your emails have just broken down really difficult information and made it easier for me to understand. And I'm just really grateful for the work that you do. And for public service workers, we are the backbone of this country. Do not let anyone make you feel less. And we deserve to have our student loans forgiven for all the hard work and energy and passion. You know, our job may end at 3:15, but we are the ones who are working and tutoring our students, helping our students throughout the night, throughout summers, even though people love to say like, well, you only work 11 months a year. Okay, I don't get a paycheck during the summer. I'm not making an income during the summer unless I do a second job. So don't give up, reach out. And even though it could be uncomfortable, in order to get comfortable, we need to fight through the uncomfortability.
Well, my wife usually doesn't listen to my podcasts, but I'm going to make her listen to at least the end of this one.
I promise you didn't pay me to say anything. This is all real.
Well, it's, you know, so thank you so much, Taylor, for being on today's show. Everybody, ask your questions, reach out to us, share this information with your community. And thank you, Taylor, for being on the show. Thank you to everyone. That is another episode in the books, the Student Loan Planner Podcast.